is my request. You don't have to play it, but I hope you'll do your best. I've been listening to your show on the radio, and you seem like a friend to me.
Party to hop on for 8 o'clock at the Greater 3UZ Sammy Show for Friday night.
Okay, the time is 22 before 9, 1272 SM with Ian McRae in the morning.
4AP and Kevin Hillier, Sunday morning, out for a couple of showers later today and a top of 25.
Well, it's 27 past 12 right now. This is Laurie Bennett at 2SM.
At 24 to 8 with Peter Grayson, town at the moment 17 degrees.
Howdy, hi, Victoria. Stan the man. Hello.
Well, hi, and welcome once again to Pilots of the Airwaves. It is our 40 minutes or so where we get to speak to the people behind the voices who were friends to a whole generation. And today's guest clocked up 50 years in the business, spending time in Queensland, Victoria and South Australia, but eventually choosing to settle in Tassie. Now, you may know him as Super Jock or Locko, depending on where you live, but to most of us, it's a very versatile...
Mike O'Loughlin.
It's very pretty down St Kilda Road. In the parks and gardens, all the trees are shaking out their heavy load. It's a beautiful time of year. Aren't you glad you're here with 1422 3XY?
Hey, Mike O'Loughlin, welcome to Pilots and thanks for joining us.
Absolute pleasure, Paul. Good to be here. Nice to talk to radio people again while in retirement.
Yeah, we'll put that talk of retirement to the side for a moment. Let's roll it right back to those days in the mid-60s in your hometown of Adelaide. So which was the station and who were the jocks that were igniting your passion for radio when you were in your teens?
Interestingly enough, it was Dave W. Whitcomb. There was Leon Biner, Barry Bissell in the early days, that sort of thing. And that's when I was at college. I was a boarder at college, which I absolutely hated. And used to listen to the radio as you did in those days. You listen to Night and good old rock and roll and gosh knows. And I saw it, and I'd finished school, and finally a job came up and it said cartridge operator, 5KA, the rock station. And I went, ooh, I'll have a crack. And I went in there, Paul, which is very funny, with my old school tie, which was a college tie. And I was interviewed by a bloke called Vaughan Harvey. And another guy there was Roger Dowson. I don't know whether those names mean anything to you, but I don't think they're any longer with us. But Vaughan said, what school? I told him, da-da-da-da-da. And he said, asked a couple of ordinary questions, and he said, you've got the job because you've got your old school tie on. I used to go there. And I went, how does that? And I hated school, was hopeless at it, didn't like the college. But it got me at my start in radio.
Now, how excited were you to take those first steps into the industry and to be walking around the halls of a real live radio station?
Look, it was really good. It was shift work in those days, as you probably would be aware, and it was cartridges, the old Plessy cartridges. Our job, I was with Tony Gordon, Lindsay Ryan and myself, and we did shifts. And so you do it, I think, an eight-hour shift. And we'd record from the old rollers to 45 to something else to put on a 16-minute Plessy. And we had the announcer's logs there, and whatever shift you do on, you do so many logs. It'd take forever. And you do their entire shift logs, and you'd bracket them and then put the end cue, and you had to make them really tight, blah, blah, blah. And that was – but it was exciting because you were in radio and you're walking down the corridors. When we did the night shift, there were some pranks from some of the announcers that were quite bizarre. And when you're a kid, it's like, this is just glorious fun.
So during that time, were you involved in or attending any announcer school, for example?
Never went to one. No.
First honorary appointment was at 2MO in Gunnedah, a mere 1,469 kilometres from Adelaide via Broken Hill. So how did that appointment come about?
I applied. This is really interesting because when Paul Thompson was the program director at the time, and he said to the rest of us, look, we're going automated, da-da-da-da, your jobs will be redundant. What would you like to do? And I said, I want to go on air. And I mean, I sounded like a chipmunk. I still do a bit. But the he said, look, you've got to send out audition tapes. And as you know, okay. So I said, and I asked the guys around me who were the, just in my opinion, the best. They said, here's what you do, music and a bit of this and a bit of that. I sent out, I didn't forget it, 36 reel-to-reel tapes to different radio stations to get a job. I got 36 knockbacks. Now, interestingly enough, Gunnedah rang me up and said that two guys applied. I was one of them. The other guy didn't want to come. Would you like the job? True story. And I said, of course I would. Where is it? And that's when I found out it was on the junction of the Namoi and the Mukau rivers and all of that. And off I toddled to Gunnedah and didn't realise where it was, who it was, how it was. I had to finish at midnight. I had to wear a tie on, in the studio, and I did 6 to midnight. And then you play the national anthem and close the station down.
So what was life like for a young guy in a place known as the koala capital of the world?
Does it? I never saw one there. It was, look, it was an interesting life, fun, single, you know, young guy, caught up with some other young guys. We just had fun, joined, in those days we joined the local club because that's what you did. And the local club, you had to be 21 and I was under 21. So you had a junior medallion, but you could still go to and have a few beers, and you did all those. It was not rock and roll. It was not what you'd think it might be. But my production talents from the early days in Adelaide, from production and cartridge, they gave me a whole heap of Deutsche Welle tapes with all these interviews, Susie Quattro and someone. So I cheated a bit. I remember in Gunnedah, and I recorded myself asking the questions and played them back. And they thought, God, this guy's, you know, he knows what he's doing, this lad. Of course, I was cheating badly. I do what I want to do. Go where I want to go. We live where we want to live. Ooh, try what I want to try. Buy what I want to buy. We listen to the music we like best. 3B.
Now, the next move brought you slightly closer to home at 3BO in Bendigo. I dare say a far different community to that of Gunnedah.
Really was. It was in the old Pall Mall, in the upstairs, in the Beehive building, in the old original building, which was with Gene Fisker. I don't know whether you know it. Gene was there. A few others, some of them sadly no longer with us. And I wasn't there long, but I was made the music director after a short period of time, I think, because I was the youngest bloke there. Terry Taylor was the manager at the time, and I was I really enjoyed it there. And but then another, I think I was only there a short while, maybe only less than a year. And a mate of mine was at Wyala in 5AU Wyala, and he said, "Look, do you want to come up and be a studio supervisor and do afternoons?" And I went, "Oh, you know, like I've got a title. This is big for a lad." So, of course, I said, yeah, I'll take that job, and left 3BO. I went to Wyala, which, believe me, was different.
Just in terms of Bendigo, you mentioned there Gene Fisk, but also to Steve Britton, Adam Joseph. No doubt you had plenty of fun.
We did. Adam Joseph, what a great guy. Look, soul of the earth. It was Bendigo, even then, was a really busy, thriving community, if you will. But going back to the early days, they had a double-decker bus they used on a street and went round, and they did all sorts of pretty crazy, fabulous promotions. I kind of regretted leaving, to be honest with you.
So Bendigo to 5AU in Wyala and then 4CA in Cairns in relatively short amount of time with lots of kilometres covered. So was it all because of new challenges and opportunities, sense of adventure, or just a bit of restlessness?
Look, I've got to say, Paul, good question, and a little bit of all of that. In those days, if you remember, which is so different to now, in those days you really had to go do the miles, get lots of radio stations under your belt to make it, if you would, in radio. They needed to see you've got a lot of experience. And I thought, I can do that. Mum and Dad backed me, and off I toddled again and went 3 million miles to Cairns. But I'd also made friends with a guy that became the program director in Adelaide at 5AD, Jeff Warden, and who was in those on air is known as Warden Jeff, I think, in those days, interestingly enough. And Fatty Francis, Bob Francis, was the station manager. What a bloody legend. He actually came to my 50th birthday many years ago, which was sensational. Good to see him on his Harley. But going back, I mean, that was – so I got offered this job and I said, we want you to come in down and do nights at 5AD. So I wasn't at 4CA very long and the manager there wasn't terribly impressed. And they called me Mad Mike in the morning. And, of course, I was there for 5 minutes and Mad Mike left the station and went to 5AD Adelaide to do work to do nights, 6 to 9pm.
Now, of course, Grant Goldman was on the roster at the time, and let's say he helped you up your profile there in the City of Churches.
He nicknamed me Super Jock. Don't ask me, because I know there was a Super Jock in America, etc. So he said, oh, yes, and blah, blah, blah. So I became Super Jock on the radio. The writers at the station at the time thought, that's better than Mike O'Loughlin, which is boring. We'll call you Super Jock, and we'll do a request show, 6 to 9, off we go. And I did that for a while until Goldie left and I ended up doing Drive.
Now, at the time, 5AD was right on the top of its game. So who were some of the other jocks you shared the roster with?
Oh, gosh. Baz and Pilker, of course, who were absolute bloody legends. They were doing breakfast and it was just a pleasure to be in the same vicinity. They were so great. But, I mean, I'll never forget, we had office meetings and Peter Butler became the PD and he didn't like me very much. And there's another guy, Trevor, there once came up to me and said, the only advice I can give you is leave radio. You're awful. And I thought, okay, that was not very nice. And then Bob Francis pulled me into his office one day and he showed me, I don't know whether people would remember this if they've ever gone to his office in those days. He had a Perspex container with a huge amount of cow dung in it. And he had a plaque on the front that said, lest we not forget, it's all bullshit. And I thought, you know, and he said, remember that. And I went, okay. And I thought, funniest for a general manager, you know, this is me in the rock and roll days. And it's like, this is crazy. And the 10th floor of the advertiser building at 5AD was absolutely bizarre, but interesting. And then I did clash a little bit. Luckily, I got offered a job in Melbourne at 3DB. And I knew I had to take it because I didn't take it. I wasn't getting on too well. I had number one surveys, but that didn't mean too much in those days if the people didn't. And I don't know why, but I clashed a little bit with a couple of them. Not with Bass and Pilko, only with management. Not with Fatty, but more or less with PDs.
As you said, Melbourne was the next stop at 3DB during their Rhythm of the City phase. Now, I dare say that 5AD and 3DB had their similarities, but tell me, what was the main difference between the Adelaide marketplace and the Melbourne marketplace?
3DB was in what we used to call the bowels of the Herald. And I worked with Don Lunn, you know, and for me, absolute bloody highlight of my life, the guy was magic. And we became quite good pals. A lot of the other guys, but Stan Rope was there as well. But I suddenly was working with names I'd heard about, and I was this fledgling night guy, and they all helped me do stuff. But they helped me do stuff and be quite bizarre. That's when a bloke called Greg Smith, who was at 3XY, heard me and offered me the job, and I moved there. So things were progressing. But gosh, it does sound like I moved to a lot of radio stations pretty quickly.
Speaking of 3XY and Greg Smith, how conscious were the management of DB at the time on taking on that all-conquering, all-powerful 3XY?
Look, they were really, really aware of it, and we tried very hard with promotions, OBs, that sort of thing. But 3XY was a juggernaut at the time. It was a juggernaut, I'd have to be honest with you. And the King Street Studios moving into there from the Age Building was insane. I mean, it was just... you had all the best of the best, you know, the Kevin Hilliers to you know, Brecky. I mean, they're all so good. It wasn't, and that 3DB had the legends, you know, not me, but the Stan Rose and the Don Nuns and that sort of thing. They were very good, but it was sort of, it wasn't quite the young and in thing. So it was destined, I think, and I can look, only look backing on it now, by the way. We're all great in hindsight. But, I mean, looking back now, no, I didn't think it would have had a chance. And obviously it did change.
So just reflecting on your time at 3DB, what were some of the highlights?
Oh, gosh. Interviews with the village people, which went pear-shaped. Absolutely. That was so weird. Look, and also the interesting part in the studio, it's the first time I'd worked on a studio with railway lines. So your seat had a – you're on a railway line. And you couldn't go side to side, turn around and do any bloody thing. You had to go forward and back. And I don't know how many times I built it into things backwards and front. Oh, look. So, look, I don't know what their highlights, but they were fun times anyway.
The spirit of rock and roll.
I feel like I need to whisper after that one. Now, just after FM radio started to emerge, you made the crosstown switch to the spirit of rock and roll at 3XY to join the likes of Peter Harrison, Gary Suprane, Bill Ally, and of course Peter O'Callaghan. Definitely was a transition time for XY, but still no doubt exciting to be part of with a good crew of announcers.
Look, I became best mates with a couple of them because Peter O'Callaghan and I were incredibly close. His nickname was Poco. And, of course, then he said one day, well, I'd love to do a show with you and we could do, I'll call you Loco, O'Loughlin, Loco. And I thought, oh, fine. And we'll spell it the same way, Poco, P-O-C-C-O-L-O-C-O. And I went, oh, well, that sounds bloody weird. Have a crack. So they kind of did on and off. And that was really, look, I've got to say, exciting and different. I mean, later on I might tell you if I'm brave enough to a story that Greg Smith had to take me off air for a day and send me home with a rather nasty letter, which I ended up framing and keeping for the rest of my life because I didn't believe I actually said it on air. But we'll talk about that later.
Yes, you can be assured, Mike, that we'll get a run later on. Now, just wondering if we could run the Mike O'Loughlin Tuck-In Club, a club where members have been tucked in by Mike O'Loughlin. Do you think we could run that these days in these politically correct days of 2024?
Would never happen. I had Peter Brock as a guest, and the reason I got him is I bought secondhand a Brock Commodore HDT car number 54. And those days, you're on reasonable money, so I could afford it. I wish I still had it, by the way. It would probably pay for several houses. But I had Brocky drive it to this thing, and we'd take a recorder with us, and people had to be in their jammies, and they'd have a party. And nine times out of ten, there'd be alcohol and cake and gosh knows, and it was outrageous. We took a lot of footballers, of course, too. They loved it to bits, and we'd record them and we'd tuck them into bed. We actually did tuck them into bed, all legit, all above board, but hilarious, and you would never, ever get away with it today.
Now, by the time you left 3XY and then moved to 3KZ for a short time, was the influence of FM starting to take a grip on the music stations?
Yeah, it was actually, Paul, especially you could feel it was where the new trends were, but nobody was quite into the FM thing yet with the radios and the rest of it. They hadn't quite got the technology into their head yet, the listeners, in my opinion. So it was really interesting, and I think that's where 3XY survived to the last death knell, if you will.
3GL on the West Coast.
There was a return to breakfast in Bendigo, as you mentioned earlier, and then down to the Victorian West Coast to 3GL, which of course then became K-Rock. What was the attraction of heading to Geelong?
Actually, a mate of mine, when I was at 3XY, I did a TV show managed by Sue Smith, who became Michael Gudinski's wife, and she worked at 3XY in promotions, I think. And we did a show called WROK Rock on live at 5 on 10. It lasted, I think, 8 to 12 months. I can't remember exactly. And I did the Melbourne version. A bloke called Ian Grace did the Sydney version, but we recorded it at AAV Studios. And we had a pretend radio studio. You had heaps of writers. You had bands, all of that, and they recorded live, and it was on the telly at 5. Well, Gracie, Ian Grace, I was at in Bendigo, and he hunted me up, and, you know, I was doing breakfast, and I didn't mind that second time in Bendigo at all. But he rang me up and said, look, we're changing 3GL, and we need a breakfast announcer just to go there, and then we need a breakfast announcer to do K-Rock when we open it up. Are you willing, and blah, 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 and help out in programming? And I said, yeah, look, because then the money was pretty outrageously good at that for that office. So I said, yeah, off I went. Went down there, went to the old building at 3GL, which was kind of historic, and I really enjoyed it. Some good people there. I'm trying to think of some of the names because, gosh. But in the end, went to the K-Rock at the Commonwealth Bank building and did brekkie there for a while, and then worked with Bogart Torelli. And Bogart, who's been still on air in Sydney, just, gosh, the most beautiful, wonderful voice, lovely lady. God, I loved her. She was great to work with. We did some pretty crazy, crazy things, but it was a good time.
Now, we're talking about a regional town with only two FM stations, K-Rock and Bay FM, and you worked at both of them in succession. Was that a difficult decision to move from one to the other?
Not really, because I got sacked from K-Rock when the new PD came in, and didn't get on with him at all. Matter of fact, to this day, he's the one person I really can't stand at all, which was a shame. Years later, I became a station manager, and the manager then, Steve Robinson, came up to me later when I was a manager. We were working together in two different stations, and he said, I'm really sorry about that time. It was a really awful time. And Mark Day was a bloke who owned newspapers and a small bunch of radio stations. He owned Bay FM at the time. And he said, would you come over and work for me doing breakfast? I didn't have a choice, Paul. I got the flick. So I went over to Bay FM and did breakfast, and then worked. I got a brand new lady on the brekkie with me called Belinda King, BJ, who's on the ABC here and is just the loveliest lady. And we worked really well together. And then, how's this? You're going to love this. Then Hoyts decided to, I think they bought Bay FM from Mark Day. This same guy that sacked me came over and sacked me again. And I went, you're kidding. And I probably did make several death threats.
Speaking of management, you did deviate from behind the microphone to behind the disc, taking up a number of program director and station manager positions towards the end of the 90s. So were they roles you enjoyed, or was your forte always in communication?
Always as a communicator, loved breakfast, did really enjoy it, and it was incredible. When I was at 4RO there for a while, I got a program, and I had to change it from 4 records only to, you know, and put in the wizard system in those days, help and all that sort of stuff, and I was pretty new at it. We did very well, and I was offered a job at 2GO and Gospel as PD and drive or afternoons, moved around. So did that. And while I was there, I did a course with AFTERS for a sales manager, which was, I'd never done any sales. I thought, and it was interesting, and I wanted to increase. So I thought, well, the only way to get on, and my goal when I was, and if I should have told you this, when I was a cartridge operator, was to be a manager of a radio station. I wanted to go from the lowest of the low to the top. That was my goal. I told my parents that and all that sort of stuff. And they sort of said, yeah, good luck. But I ended up doing very well at this AFTERS course. Got 86%. And Reece Holloran was the boss of the network. And Reece said, we bought a few radio stations. We'd like to appoint you manager of Mackay, CFM Mackay. I went, you're kidding me. Bloody hell. So I went from program director to Mackay as a manager there. For a little while, personality got into it with a wife that didn't like the moves, the changes, the rest of it. So that we broke up. The job suffered. Bingo. That was the end of being a manager for a while.
Mm. Now, your longest stretch at the station was your second stint at 4CA in Cairns, where it was 12 years of entertaining those good folk of northern Queensland. To stay that long must have been a pretty enjoyable experience.
Loved it to death. Still do. some of my closest friends are still in Cairns. Yeah, look, gee, it went through a million managers. It went through a whole heap of owners, changed names. It did so many different things, but we hung in there. And in the end, it was my first taste, tiny taste of talk, because they bought Easy Mix, AM Easy Mix, and they said, would you go and do breakfast talk music? And I said, oh, yeah, all right, okay, I've never done that. I'll give it a go there. So I kind of enjoyed that too. 4CA, though, I worked with Juanita, and she was just another one that we, and we're still the best of mates today to this day. And she's married with a couple of kids, and Gus, her hubby, and the kids. I adore them. So a lot of friends in Cairns, loved Cairns. The time there was fantastic. It was only because of change of ownership and management and things got a bit toxic that we left. And I actually met my future wife in Cairns, which we're still together decades later, which is not a decade, but, you know, which is wonderful to see. I'm loving it. And so it was a positive time for us, really.
So how did the new century O'Loughlin style of broadcasting differ from those of the super jock in Adelaide?
Oh, woof. Different because you really had to get away from being anything like a super jock. You had to be, it was all about local, and I specialised in local content. So I made my goal was always be local, make the listener own the radio, do all of those things, take as many phone calls as you could, blah, blah, blah. None of this, by the way, was ever taught to me. It was just learning the ropes and going, it's the only way to be successful. And then when they did have surveys, we were number one. When they got a shock that there's this silly bloke called O'Loughlin or Locko. I was known as Locko then in those days. Everyone said Locko. So I said, how the hell is he still going? But, I mean, we still went. We did well. But, yeah, it's more localism. And then I think nowadays they've kind of learnt that, except I think the failure nowadays is too many people buying up too many radio stations. And no, the localism has gone out the window.
Now, Mike, as well as broadcasting in Cairns, you did dabble in some teaching of media studies. How enjoyable was that side interest?
Oh, gee, it was bloody good. What happened was there was about 10 community radio stations in around Queensland at the time that didn't have much of an idea. Really, they didn't. And a lot of them were in Indigenous areas. So they said, and I was a qualified trainer. I went to TAFE, got my qualifications, Cert 4, blah, blah, blah. And so I thought, look, I'll teach media studies, Cert 1 and 2, which is a couple of certificates, get them RTO through a TAFE in Cairns. And they got a bunch of Indigenous students down from various communities, and we made a class of it. We did it for quite a while, like 2 weeks stint, break, 2 weeks, that sort of thing, till they were capable of getting their Cert 1, then their Cert 2 if they wanted to, and give them some idea of actually knowing what to do in a radio station, because a lot of them had no idea. I mean, not. I just think they'd put a CD in and let it run, you know, that sort of thing. No idea. So it was, and it was to meet some of them. I've never met so many colourful characters in my life. They were insane. I can't say what they said to me in bits and pieces because it was too colourful, but lovely. Look, loved them. Just funny people and gorgeous.
So, Mike, as well as training these people and telling them of your life experiences, did you actually teach them how to read advertising copy?
CompuShape, take one.
Hey, you're looking trim. What's your secret?
I joined CompuShape and I feel terrific.
What's...
Take two, take three, take four, take five...
Hey, you're looking trim. What's your secret?
I joined CompuShape and I feel terrific.
What's CompuShape? I'm sorry.
Don't apologise. Laughing's good for you.
That is stimulates good for you.
Oh, you've caught me. Look, I used to find production the most fun ever, and doing and still did, even getting into when I was in talk. You'd go on production, you'd have fun with the guys, and they loved it. If you had fun with them, you always did a bit better work, I guess, and if you could laugh.
Absolutely. Now, your partner in crime there, of course, Liz Sullivan from 3KZ and 3XY Breakfast. Very talented broadcaster in her own right.
Isn't she gorgeous? Look, honestly, she really became one of my closest friends, just gorgeous lady. She was the one that actually got me over to 3KZ because she said, look, you need to because 3XY, blah, 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 is going to be finishing, it's going to go to FM and blah, whatever. So, you know, I was grateful to her for that opportunity.
Good music, good friends and great company, 1263 SR.
Now, 2012 was a shift back to Victoria with the word on the street that Locko was going to be a man on the land, which in fact turned out to be 8 years on 3SR, rebranded, of course, to Triple M in 2016. Was there a bit of high country action in between the mornings on air?
Yeah, it was interesting, and it was always Locko, not Loco, because Loco is like a nutcase. But, I mean, no, it was I left because I went back to the family farm, if you will, to help out a little bit there, and that was in Thornton. There was a massive, massive property, and they're breeding Angus bulls. And I was I went over to 3SR at the time, and I remember Leanne was the manager, a nice lady, and Reese was her boyfriend. I'm thinking, oh, good heavens, Reese Holloran. And they said, look, we're in a bit of strife with our breakfast crew. Would you like to do breakfast here? That was eventually. And I thought, you're kidding me. So that's how I got to do the breakfast there. Then it became, yeah, it went from 3SR to Triple M. And I'm thinking, oh, heavens, here we go. But honestly, it was good. And my wife was in sales then. I probably didn't tell you, my wife was actually my boss at one stage, was a general manager in Cairns of the two stations, was actually my boss. So it was great. I was sleeping with management, loved it.
Obviously a better relationship than you had with the guy down there in Geelong. Hey, Mike, after clocking up 48 years on radio, some of your greatest acknowledgements came in your final 2 years with your highly successful Tasmania Talks.
It's the home of Tasmania Talks, leading Tasmania's conversation. This is Mike O'Loughlin.
Now, the program was syndicated across a fair stretch of Tassie and attracted 4 ACRA nominations in 2 years, culminating in the award for the Best Networked Show Provincial in 2022. Tell me, did you leave the best to last?
It was, I'd never done a full talk, right? Never done. And I had the most beautiful producer, Rhea. She was gorgeous. And Rhea's, I think, in Hobart now doing producing, but she was just talented and very helpful to me and a wonderful young lady. So it was kind of handy. But I loved the fact that it was all talk. I mean, you might play one record an hour. Oh, sorry, one record a shift if you're lucky. One song a shift. Don't say records anymore, but anyway. And we had they put in the new system, Zeta, and all that sort of stuff. So we're all au fait with all the latest blah, blah. But it was interesting because I, old school, I wrote down every question and then I'd try and ad-lib a few and get it happening. And I wasn't a Darren Hinch or a shock jock ever. But when they did the survey, we actually beat the ABC, which is the first time that that shift's ever been able to beat the ABC. So I was pretty bloody pleased with that. And then, the first year I did it, we got some ACRA nominations. And so that was lovely. Didn't win any. We got became finalists. So we're finalists. I got 3 finalist certificates. Loved that. Then the next year, as I said, up we go again with the 3 more. But we won 2. Rhea won one as producer, and I won one for the networking across. But I mean, it was, you know, to go up there and to receive it was good. And that's when I kind of suddenly said, well, that makes November makes 50 years in radio. Might be a good time.
And of course, Mike, you don't get the opportunity all the time to call it quits on your own terms. Hey, listen, in terms of presenting a music format compared to an all talk format, what's the differences?
Enormous. I'd be at work at 6. You'd need to read 5 newspapers, you know, or race through 5 newspapers. I used to colour what I'd need, cut out, cut and paste and that, because you couldn't type in there quick, because you had to just go with the papers, because it's, as you know, you can't just switch between screens. So you're working the papers, you're doing all of that. The prep was phenomenal, I've got to say. And then when you come off, there was more prep, and you did that, and that was it pretty well did my head in. I mean, I the guy I replaced only lasted 1 year. He couldn't do it. He went back to Rocky, lovely guy. But anyway, there's just a lot of work involved. And the only reason I left is because I got crook and 50 years and I won an award. And I thought, it can't get any better than this. Well, except for the crook bit.
50 years in the business, on reflection, the most productive and satisfying Mike O'Loughlin era.
Oh, golly. 4CA Cairns, I'd have to say, was most productive. The second stint there, that was really, I mean, that was, I kind of about then started to grow up and knew what I was doing, I think. Just took a long time. That was really what different to a really fun, outrageous time, which would be, you know, 3XY, 5AD, and those. That was just kind of outrageous, and all the different things we did. But yeah, I'd say 4CA Cairns, the FM side of it, and working with Juanita on air was fun, creative, good. That was probably a really good time.
Okay, a couple of quick questions just to finish off this section. Is it true you rode from Geelong to Albury on a Harley to read ads for a pizza shop?
Yes. I had three Harleys in my day. I loved them, and I ended up with three. And I had to leave. My wife said, you've got to get rid of the last one, so I did, and I'm very sad about it. But anyway, yeah, I did. You've done your homework, Paul. I rode up there, and I got paid a lot of money, a silly amount of money, to read an ad for a pizza plop. So it was 2AY Albury I'd go into. Rod Bryce was on air, and Rod and I were mates at the time. And he'd say, what are you doing? He'd say, I'm reading the ad. And he said, God. And they couldn't believe it. And my voice, here's me reading this ad when there were better voices around, but they loved it. That was interesting.
Okay, Mike, did you ever get any correspondence from the Broadcasting Control Board?
Oops, I did. Now we go back to that little bit. When I was doing the tuck-in club, you got a certificate and you got all sorts of fun things. And I, at one stage there, way back when, a bloke called John Denver, the late John Denver, was touring. And I thought, oh, that's good. He's touring. And people were saying at this party, and I love him, and someone didn't, someone did. What do you think, Mike? Oh, and I said, John Denver put the C in country. And I actually said the C word. So, and remember, it's all recording. So it wasn't live, it was recording. John Denver put the C in country. And I thought, oh, well, that'll get cut out, you beaut. No, didn't. And because whether the producer thought I'd put that in because that's fun. So anyway, I go to play it the next night. Bingo, on air. John Denver put the, I went, oh, no. So calls came in, management, Greg Smith, the PD, all that, you're off air, da-da-da-da-da, off air immediately and off air the next day. And I got a beautiful letter, which I kept framed for the rest of my life, which we thought was very funny.
In retrospect. Now, Mike, what did they have you doing at the Carra Mine in Blackwater?
That was when a really short-lived job, but that was when the management job and the marriage and all the rest of it, Mackay and a bloke said to me, he said, look, it's a fairly high-paid job for a short time. Can you help us out in sales? And I said, oh, yes. And Carra, so I went there. I was actually in sales, went into the mine, and you had to sell like a production facility for oils, all of that, and the machinery. It was bloody fascinating, I've got to tell you. And the money they paid people then in those days was, three, four times what you got as a breakfast or even a general manager. Crazy money. So, yeah, I loved it. Sadly, the bloke came back and I had to get a real job.
Okay, here's one for you. Tell us about the Tom Quilty 160-kilometre endurance ride on horseback.
Oh, the Tom Quilty. Tom Quilty was an old gold miner in the years ago, and he became friends with a bloke called R.M. Williams. And they loved this ride, 100-mile. They called it a 100-mile ride on horseback in America. And Tom Quilty said, look, I'm going to make a gold cup. If you want to promote it, R.M. Ray, I think was his name. And R.M. Williams and Tom Quilty got together and they made a solid gold cup. And you had to do, you got a fit horse. You'd start all over. So I did end up doing, I think, 10, 15 years of these things, lots of them, never won any. But the thing was to complete is to win. So I ended up getting to win. You get a gold and silver buckle to finish. I ended up getting 7 buckles over the years. But you start at midnight on a Saturday night. It's the roughest, hardest 100 miles, 160 Ks you've ever done in your life. You have a vet check when you come in. You have a vet check all the way through to make sure your horse is sound and you're looking after your horse. If your horse's heart rate's up, that's when you're gone. But it was, it was amazing time. Really was. The Tom Quilty, and to this day it still goes, I think.
Now, I know nothing about horse riding, but I assume receiving 7 completion buckles is a bloody good effort in anyone's language.
Yeah, it was a lot of effort, a lot of work, and you'd get off and you'd walk your horse a bit, you'd make sure you fed it. And I bred Arabs, and I had 2 Arab stallions. And the stallion I did very well with was a horse called Zahir. The most unbelievable. Like, he could be a nasty piece of work in a paddock sometimes, but when he got to work and had to do what he had to do, he just did it, and his heart rate was brilliant. Loved it.
Okay, quick review. Great communicator, fine horseman, keen motorbike rider in your day. There's also a strong bond with cycling thanks to the keen interest in the sport by your late brother David. Now, with both of you in town together, that O'Loughlin profile must have been huge in Cairns for a while.
Oh, good heavens, you've done your homework. It was David, my late brother, introduced me to the RagBri, which is the Registers a Great Annual Great Bicycle Ride across Iowa, which you put your back wheel in the Missouri River, and 7 days later you put your front wheel in the Mississippi. And so, but you had to join a club. So we joined it. My brother got me to join a club. We did cycling in Cairns all over the place with clubs. We did the Cairns to Corumba, I think 7, 8, 9 times, which was all raising money for charity in different groups. That was just wonderful fun. That still goes to this day, and it's great. Well, you go over there. We joined this club called the Whiners. It's like the Whingers, the Whiners. And it was Forkmore Pork was their logo. And the craziest bunch of people you've met in your life, they lent us tent and bikes and everything. And they were really good. Cost not a lot of money. And you'd ride, and there was a river of cyclists every day. There'd be 40, 50,000 people on the road. No cars allowed. Police everywhere. You're on B roads. And you'd go to these towns, and the towns, there were a couple of D9s with a cable stretch. You'd put your bike up, and off you'd go. And one interesting time, I'm riding with a guy, and he said, "Hey, you're an arsey." And I said, "Yeah, you can tell. Is it because I've got a koala on my head or something?" But anyway, because I did. And he said, "Do you want me to show you my gun?" I said, "Oh, don't. I'm on a push bike. I don't have any guns." Sure enough, in his little pack at the back behind his saddle, he had a Magnum. And he said, "I always carry it with me," and blah, blah, blah. And I went, "Oh, no." So, of course, he let me take photos with it and do all that. No, they loved it. And I just sort of rode away from him after that. Sort of, thankfully, got lost into the mire of other cyclists. But you'd have, remember one police officer fully, you know, everyone wore guns everywhere. This gun mentality was insane. And they said, "Hey, you guys," at 7 o'clock in the morning, and it's about my first or second day. And they said, "Hey, you guys, just go around the corner. We're having margaritas for only $1.30, raising money for the local fire department." And I said, "Fellas, it's 7 o'clock in the bloody morning, mate. I couldn't sip a beer." Anyway, we did have to go around, and you had to have a margarita. So I had a couple of sips. It was just dreadful that time of the day. Then you'd cycle on, and everything's on the side of the road, so you eat your lunch and do all that. In the end, you'd camp. And next day, more and more until you finished and put your front wheel in the Mississippi. Unbloody believable. And people did it in cow horns, nuns' uniforms, Elvis Presley outfits. You know, imagine crazy and you've got it. Rhythm of the city,
103 dB. Okay, Mike, time for those dozen or so questions we ask all our guests. First one, of course, being, where were you when you heard that John Lennon had died?
Adelaide Radio, and that was when everybody brought out Imagine. Brought out the song and off it went. And it was probably more shock than anything because you just don't think, do you, that people are going to walk along. And now we all think, yeah, well, look what the world's become. But that was really quite shocking.
The last concert ticket you paid for, Mike?
Rod Stewart in Adelaide.
Okay. Is there a concert act that you regret never seeing?
Bruce Springsteen. Oh, I wish I had. Love Bruce Springsteen. Got the albums. Missed it.
Mike, that word that you had most trouble pronouncing on air?
Efficacy. And I've trained myself to make sure I could say it to you, Paul. Efficacy. Because, I mean, when the bloody talk radio and people were, you know, the efficacy of the vaccines and blah, 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 I had so much trouble with that word. Oh, my heavens. Anyway, don't now.
Was there ever an incident on air that had you thinking you might get those, "Hey, listen, we can leave that one out because I think we know the answer to that one already"? How about Skyhooks or Sherbet?
Skyhooks. I actually loved it. I got on really well. I met Sherl a few times, and as you did in those days, you met them and Greg McCain and all that. The Saturn didn't quite do it for me, and it was the kind of the weirdness and the fun of Skyhooks as compared to the, yeah. So, yeah, Skyhooks.
The Rolling Stones or the Beatles?
Both. I'd have to say both. Only on account, I was a big fan. My first record I ever got was a 45, Hey Jude. And that was given to me by a mate. But I got all the Beatles out and loved it. I mean, I loved all their songs. And then I loved the Rolling Stones for the hardness of it.
Mike, your most treasured piece of memorabilia from those early radio days?
Oh, gosh, more than anything, I've got lots of little bits and pieces, and I've got jackets, I've got hats, I've got stubby holders, good heavens, all of that. But the signed posters when you leave and what they say on them mean more to me than anything else. And I've got some absolute crackers. Some put a couple of witty and rude sayings, but the kindness, and you can see that, yeah, it's all been pretty good. And those are probably really treasured items.
The biggest news story that broke while you were on air?
Oh, 9/11. 9/11. John Ingalls rang me. He was the PD of this network at the time. I was doing breakfast and said, mate, turn it on, blah, 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 have a look. I went, oh, my God, yeah, 9/11, but by all means. And that was just, yeah, whew. When you're on air with that, it was, I mean, you've got your die accident, you've got all of those, but 9/11 really, it was just, I think it shocked more people than anything else. It was just incredible.
Mike, was there a moment that someone walked into your studio and you were suddenly starstruck?
Never been starstruck. Interestingly, you should say that, because the only reason, when I did rock, we interviewed Rolling Stones. I interviewed a lot of people, like all these big names with Gudinski's program. When they did tour, we got to interview Gracie and I. So, but it's interesting because I never got starstruck, and I should have, but I never asked for autographs. Now, I met all of these people, like I'm talking bundles of them. I've got a couple of photos, but someone else took them, and nowadays you take a photo of whatever lunch you've had. But I wish I had, and I missed that.
Yeah, where was that iPhone when you needed it back in the 80s? Best words of advice from a program manager?
Oh, would have to be 5AD when he said, look, you've got no future, Trevor. Trevor said that to me, and he said, Mike, you've got no future in radio. Go and get another job. And I was determined more than anything else then to keep going. And that was probably it. I mean, other than that, I think Greg Smith was just a brilliant, brilliant man, grateful to work with him. And he was honest. I mean, I was lucky. I was probably the most ordinary announcer in Australia that got the longest lasting job ever and kept going. And I look back and go, how the hell did I do that? But the advice was really just was localism was always big. But, I mean, and also just the way some of them sat down and would help you with prep. And also in very early days, you'd actually go to American prep places and different places to get different things. But to find all that out, you had to talk to some. And there's some good advice in those days from PDs.
Finally, Mike, two albums that you'd consider to be the soundtrack of your teenage years.
Deep Purple, Led Zeppelin. That's it. All of Deep. I love Deep Purple, Led Zeppelin were me. I just used to, Black Knight. I mean, just all that stuff was me. I was a rock and roll junkie, I think, in those days, you'd have to say. So that would be, I mean, I couldn't say there's no, you know, I'm not a Swiftie. So all of that. But, I mean, I know millions are, and bless them for it, because she's great and original. And I personally love what she does to country towns and people everywhere she goes. I mean, she's good for the bloody country. But, yeah, just for me, it was rock and roll.
Well, Mike, 50 very diverse years in the industry, and within that time you've also helped many aspiring announcers along the way, a career that you can be justifiably proud of.
Thanks, Paul. And I was made a mentor there for a while too, but it was actually great, because a lot of people, when they ask you questions, you've just got to have the ability to sit and listen and then give them an idea of what they can do next. I mean, I did upset a few because they wanted a job and I couldn't hire them, and that, you know, blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, there's been characters more than characters. Just been, and it's, thank you for saying that, but it's great to be appreciated, but it's great to see that someone can move on and do really well.
Hey, Mike, keep fighting the good fight health-wise, and thanks so much for joining us today.
A pleasure, Paul. Good to talk to you.
Mike O'Loughlin on Pilots of the Airwaves.